From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with cinematographer and director Ed Lockman. The impressive list of people he's worked with includes Jean-Luc Godard, Werner Herzog, Bernardo Bertolucci, Paul Schrader, and David Byrne. This weekend, he'll be honored at the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema. Also, we talk with Frances Lear, the founder of Lear's Magazine. She says she didn't really come into her own until she reached her 60s. In her new memoir, she writes about being sexually abused by her stepfather, her several suicide attempts, and her low self-image when she was known to the public as the wife of Norman Lear. And guest film critic John Powers reviews Lethal Weapon 3. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations Security Council today demanded that the Yugoslav Army and the Croatian Army both withdraw from Bosnia. The draft resolution demands the disarming of the demobilized troops and asks Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali to determine how to protect relief convoys and the Sarajevo airport. Boutros-Ghali has already ruled out a new UN peacekeeping operation in Bosnia. He says it's too dangerous. He's also expressed concern for the safety of the 14,000 peacekeepers already deployed in Croatia. The U.S. government says the number of Haitians leaving their country in small boats is rising again. On Wednesday alone, 1,000 were picked up by the Coast Guard. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
U.S. officials expect that more boat people will be intercepted this month than ever before. The previous record was 6,653 last January. Only halfway through May, 5,526 had already been pulled from the sea. The reasons for the increase are not clear. The seas tend to be calm in May. Also, while most Haitians picked up by the Coast Guard are sent home, more than a third of them are deemed to have plausible claims for asylum and are brought to the United States for further questioning. Political turmoil and extreme poverty continue to plague Haiti. For Haitians willing to risk the danger of the open seas, a 1 in 3 chance of landing in the U.S. may seem like pretty good odds. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
A Superior Court judge in Los Angeles has ruled that LAPD officer Lawrence Powell will be retried on one count of assault under color of authority. Judge Stanley Weisberg will hear arguments next week about where the trial should be held. Kitty Feldy of station KLON reports.
Defense attorney Michael Stone told the court the public believes the verdicts were a catalyst for the riots that followed. He will argue that a change of venue is a must.
Getting a fair trial in the state of California is going to be problematic. Getting a fair trial in the county of Los Angeles, to me, is next to impossible.
But District Attorney Ira Reiner says the political concerns that persuaded an appeals court to move the first trial out of L.A. County no longer exist.
Irrespective of whatever dispute was taking place between the chief of police and the mayor and the police commission and all of the various elements there, that nonetheless, in Los Angeles County, a county that draws on almost 9 million people, that we could obtain a fair and impartial jury.
Defense Attorney Stone said he believed Simi Valley was an appropriate place for the last trial and would prove equally convenient this time. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost nearly 16 points to close at 3353.09. Declines led advances by a margin of about 5-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Endeavour astronauts are packing up for tomorrow's landing at California's Edwards Air Force Base. Today, Shuttle Commander Dan Brandenstein and co-pilot Kevin Chilton tested small steering rockets and fired one of the Endeavour's hydraulic power units to be certain the spacecraft will be ready for the return to Earth. If all goes as planned, Endeavour will glide to a touchdown at 1:57 Pacific time and wrap up a 9-day voyage. Republican supporters of abortion rights begin a campaign today to try and change their party's opposition to abortion. NPR's Howard Berkus has more.
The campaign begins in Salt Lake City, where the Republican Party will hold a platform committee hearing on May 26th. Abortion is one of the issues the platform panel will consider. Today, 18 billboards go up throughout the Salt Lake area saying 68% of Republicans support abortion rights. The figure is based on a survey of delegates to the 1988 Republican convention. The party and President Bush officially oppose abortion, but a group called Republicans for Choice and another called the National Republican Coalition for Choice say the party is out of step with its members. Their campaign will also include rallies and radio and television spots in an attempt to force the party to reverse its anti-abortion stance. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
Thousands of Azeri nationalists seized Azerbaijan's parliament building today after a fierce gun battle. They declare the opposition Popular Front in control of the former Soviet Republic. About 30,000 people jammed into the parliament square cheering and celebrating. The Popular Front also took over the Republic's television station, and one of the opposition leaders took to the air to declare victory. Parliament had restored the former Communist Party chief to power yesterday, 2 months after a defeat in Azerbaijan's territorial conflict with Armenia over Nagorno-Karabakh that had forced him from office. The president's current whereabouts are unknown. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The first Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema is wrapping up this weekend. Tomorrow night, the festival honors cinematographer Ed Lachman for his passion for pushing the limits of the art form in both high-profile Hollywood features and low-budget documentaries. Lachman has worked with some of the most original film directors of our time, including Jean-Luc Godard, Bernardo Bertolucci, Werner Herzog, and Paul Schrader. He also shot the documentaries Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, Say Amen, Somebody, and The World of Mother Teresa. And he's made music videos for John Cale and Lou Reed, Elvis Costello, and Annie Lennox. He shot two films which will be released this summer, London Kills Me, written and directed by Hanif Qureshi, and Light Sleeper, directed by Paul Schrader. I asked Lachman first about collaborating with the brilliant and eccentric Godard on the 1982 film Passion.
The first time I met him, he said to me, you know, I don't understand why a cameraman gets so much money. He said, Kodak does 75% of the work, and the camera does another 5%, and that maybe leaves the director another 10% of the work, and that only leaves 10% for the cameraman. So I didn't know what to say, you know.
Was it funny when he said to you that he thinks cinematographers are overpaid because they only do 10% of the work? I mean,
yeah,
I'm not sure. Did he mean that to be funny?
Well, yeah, he meant that to be funny in a way. And
I'm glad you're confident of that.
Yeah.
It would be a miserable way to open a conversation with you, wouldn't it?
Well, he wanted to negotiate my salary with me, I guess.
Americans are always reasonably baffled at the French obsession with Jerry Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you went to see a Jerry Lewis film with Jean-Luc Godard. Was this your idea?
Well,
to a Jerry Lewis film?
Yeah, I was in his office one day, and he told me he was going to a Jerry Lewis film, so I said to him, I found that amusing, and I thought he was doing kind of an injustice to our cinema by, you know, what was his obsession about Jerry Lewis? So he said, have you ever seen a Jerry Lewis film? So I said, well, maybe on television, but I don't think really in a cinema. So he said, why don't you come with me? So I went with him, and he was in tears, you know, and I was in tears watching him. And again, you see, I think what happens culturally, and this even happens to foreign films here, I believe, that another culture sees in a film the representation of that culture. In other words, he represents something, again, in a heightened reality, in some level of, maybe you could even say in a Brechtian sense, what we are as a people culturally. And even though Jerry Lewis is bigger than life, Europeans see us bigger than life.
So Godard thought that...
He sees him somehow as some metaphor for a certain psyche or consciousness about America, and that's what he finds about Jerry Lewis. It's so funny, you know.
I feel compelled to say here the French have never seen The Telephones, probably, but so Godard really loved the movie. The movie was hardly working.
Yeah.
Did you like the movie?
Not especially, but I enjoyed watching him. You know, enjoy it. And actually, that's another story. I was 35, and I told him it was my birthday that day, and he said, well, I didn't get to take you out on your birthday when you were 16, and so I can take you out on your birthday when you're 35, and maybe when you're 70. So, and which are the gauges of the film, 16 millimeter, 35, 70. Again, that was a way of him being
right, completely
funny.
Filmic mind.
Yeah,
now you worked with Werner Herzog, and you shot Strojek.
Yeah.
For him, and a film called La Soufrière, which is a really odd film. And this is a documentary about a volcano that was erupting on the island of Guadeloupe,
mm-hmm.
and everybody had evacuated except for one person, and he wanted to find that one person who hadn't mm-hmm. evacuated.
Well, I got a call from him early one morning, and he was in the editing room, and he said to me, I read about this volcano that's going to have an atomic blast worth so many megatons, and I want to go there and make this film. I hear there's a group of people or this lone individual that has risked God and country and is won't be evacuated. I want to go find them. And it was early, and my response was, what film stock are we shooting? And where is Guadeloupe? And then when I was on the plane, I realized this is insanity, but, you know, the idea of making the film took over any other presence. You always feel like you're omnipresent making a film anyway, in a way. And I arrived to Punta Pitra, the capital, and everyone was being evacuated, and there was no Werner Herzog. And I thought, this was real insanity, and this was, you know, kind of a suicide mission. And lo and behold, he arrived a day later, and myself and Werner, and there was one other cameraman, and we made this film in the island shaped like a butterfly, and we made the film on the other part. That was the part where the volcano La Soufrière was, and kind of our search was to find this group of people or this individual, and they weren't going to let anybody in that part of the island, but I guess they thought he was some German romantic, and it was kind of insanity and suicidal, and they let us in. And
well, why did you decide to stay, knowing that the situation was dangerous enough that everybody else was evacuating just as you were moving in?
Yeah, I think it was just kind of we were caught up in the idea that this was our mission, and it was kind of maybe some foolhardy romantic idea, you know, and then I believed in Werner, you know. I mean, there's a certain strength, and his films are always about kind of man pitted against natural elements, you know, and that's kind of the world that you enter with him, even though he's really on a one-to-one level one of the most sane people you know, because he's very honest and straightforward, you know, and he would never put himself in risk that he wouldn't put someone, I mean, he would always put himself in risk be above someone else first. I mean, and actually it didn't really dawn on me until I was in Basse Terre, and it was like a strange science fiction film, because we would enter people's houses and there would still be food on the table. We entered a hospital, there was babies' clothes in the waiting room. It was like a strange science fiction film. Actually, it was very peaceful. It was very calming. But you could see the volcano kind of smoking. And also, process of filmmaking, you feel like you're invincible in a way. And I was much younger. But at this time, it dawned on me because he went off and I was left alone to do a series of shots of things I found. There were a pack of dogs running around. And I said to Werner at that time, that's when it dawned on me that I was in imminent danger. And I said to Werner, what will happen if the volcano erupts? And he said, just go to the water, because there was a port there, and there'll be a boat there to pick you up. And then he went off. And I go, wait a minute. Who's going to know I'm here? What boat's going to come to pick me up? And at that point, I realized that I had entered some insane, you know, expedition, but it didn't really matter at that point. The film kind of was more important.
Were the gases from the smoking volcano affecting the shots that you were getting? Were they
actually
affecting the light?
It was very ethereal there because of the it was fog in that area. And whatever. But actually, that's what people don't know that actually the poisonous gas is what kills you before hot lava.
Good news. When did you find this out?
Well, it was there was some volcanologists there. But that was an interesting sideline, too, because there, all these different volcanologists came to try to figure out what they would do to stop the volcano. The French wanted to put a cork in it. The Americans wanted to blow it up. They thought that would be a way to eradicate the problem, an American solution. Just bomb it. The Italians wanted to put it out with water. You know, everyone had their own idea.
Did you get that on film?
Oh, sure. Sure, that's not in the film, but there was this news conference that we filmed, and everyone came up with their theory about what they could do to eradicate a volcano.
So you were inhaling these poisonous gases?
Well, they actually weren't poisonous. We were actually, as Werner says in the film, it was about an inevitable catastrophe that never happened. And
so what's your favorite shot of everything you got from this life-threatening experience?
I think maybe some of the helicopter shots, because there was no real helicopter mount. I was just hand-hold sitting in the door. It was a military helicopter that at the last minute they gave permission for us to go up, and they were so ethereal and beautiful. I think those were the things. And also it was the first time I really got to see where we were, what we were surrounded by, I guess.
My guest is cinematographer and director Ed Lachman. He's collaborated with Jean-Luc Godard, Bernardo Bertolucci, Werner Herzog, Paul Schrader, and David Byrne, to name a few. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Cinematographer and director Ed Lachman is my guest. Another director you've worked with is Bernardo Bertolucci, whose movies include Last Tango in Paris, The Conformist, The Last Emperor, and you shot Luna.
Well, I only shot the New York scenes of La Luna.
Okay. Now, his work is, I think of his work as being very, very composed, especially something like The Last Emperor and a Conformist. Did you find that working with him was a different kind of experience, and that you had to be less improvisatory, more kind of careful, pre-planned than you have with many other directors?
Well, there's certain directors that you enter their own visual world.
Yeah.
Let's say Wim Wenders I've worked with, and Werner Herzog, and Bernardo Bertolucci, and Paul Schrader. I was very familiar, and actually I did my thesis on an early film of Bernardo's before the revolution, and that's how I met Bernardo. And he's really a great cameraman in himself. I mean, he's created his own visual language to express his ideas. So he actually gets on the camera and operates the shot until it's in his mind's eye, and then he gives over the camera to the operator. And then the director of photography in his situation, even Victoria Storaro, does the lighting, and he might have some ideas, but he really leaves that up to the cameraman. So I'd really have to say Bernardo is his own cameraman.
You are, I understand, pretty selective about the films that you do. And among the films that you've turned down include Twins, the Arnold Schwarzenegger film, and Ghostbusters 2. Now, listening to you talk, I mean, you sound really like you have a very intellectual approach to making movies. Why they would have wanted someone who thinks like you do to make these kind of big pop, you know, box office smashes or potential smashes is kind of beyond me. You seem like you'd be the wrong choice.
Well, I don't want to say, you know, everything in Hollywood is, you know, to be pejorative or to say everything in Hollywood is, you know, negative. I don't mean that. It was just I read the script, and generally I'm drawn either to the director or to the material in itself, you know. And I guess in those two situations, the material, maybe I made a mistake, but the material didn't appeal to me. I didn't feel that visually I would contribute something different that somebody else couldn't do. Mm-hmm. And I guess I based it on the directors, that I wasn't that drawn to their work, so I just didn't pursue it. And why would they be drawn to me? You know, so much happens in that world that if you work on a successful film, you know, being an actor, director, cameraman,
then you're
a success. You know,
right.
If you work on a, and I guess Desperately Seeking Susan was a success and kind of a real sleeper in Hollywood's eyes, you know, where Susan Sidelman came from, where this material came from, then I was the new quotient, the new kid on the block, you know, so everybody wants what's ever new, you know. It was probably by chance, as anything else, why they showed any interest.
I want to talk a little bit about your background, because there's movies in your personal history. Your father ran a movie house, a movie theater?
Yeah, actually, my father's from Pennsylvania. He's from Chester, was from Chester. And he went to the University of Penn, and my mother went to Drexel University, and they met in Philadelphia. So that's, I guess, my background to Philadelphia. But her father owned vaudeville. So he actually had was in liquor. He was a Hungarian immigrant, and when the Prohibition came in, he bought vaudeville theaters. And when vaudeville went out, they became movie houses. And when my mother and father met, I guess that's how he got involved in, he ran one of the movie theaters in New Jersey. And then he owned one of the movie theaters himself. And then he imported Arc Carbons. They're the light projected on the screen. Now they're used, and he was also the first to bring in xenon bulbs. That's what's replaced Arc Carbons. So I was always around the cinema, you know, but I never took it very seriously. And only when I was in art school did I start to get, appreciate or see the possibilities of what image making was in cinema.
Did you ever sit in the projectionist booth at the theater?
I was putting the popcorn in the bags, and I think I liked musicals when I was younger because I'd sing to the screen and, you know, thought it was my father's theater, I could do anything, but I don't know. I thought it was just kind of entertainment. I never took it very seriously. Yeah.
So the turning point was going to school?
Yeah, I think at art school.
Because you were studying painting?
Yeah, I was studying the visual arts, and I went to Harvard for a while and then Columbia, and I always took kind of film courses. The only real film school I went to was at Ohio University, and that was just kind of, again, carved out of the art school there. And we had a camera and a processor because of the football team, and we went off and made films.
So when you started to take movies seriously, did you go through a period of thinking that the only serious films were serious art films from Europe?
Well, I didn't even know about those. I guess in college, one of the first films I saw that I got interested in imagery was Umberto D, an Italian filmmaker, De Sica's film, because it's so strongly, it was a neorealistic film, and it was so strongly based on the imagery. And I guess that's why I went to Europe then. I went to art school in Europe and France, and that's where I met a lot of these young directors, you know, in Germany, because Germany was at that time in the 60s trying to reunite itself culturally with the rest of the world, and they were funding money to this scene that was happening in Munich and in Berlin. And that's where I met Werner Herzog, and through Werner I met Wim, and then I met Fassbinder, and later I met Schlondorf, and I just happened to work with all those people.
Having gotten your start in European films, but also having made a lot of films in America, do you think that there are still any stylistic differences between American and European films?
No, I think the American independent scene, more and more, it's becoming one cinema. You know, it's just, the difference is that there's a personal vision, you know, that there's an individual vision towards the filmmaking, rather than, you know, the bigger the production, you know, the more coverage, in a way. You know, I mean, it's not to say that I think Europe has a longer tradition in imagery, and they trust images to tell their stories, where we're more based kind of in words and a lot of our filmmakers and writers come out of television, you know. And maybe also in the producing end, maybe that's the big difference, that there's a distinction made in Europe between, let's say, that a film can be made purely for artistic reasons and films can be made for commercial reasons, though everybody wants them both to be commercially viable. Here, you know, one doesn't make a film unless they feel that there's some commercial success for the film. So purely, let's say, artistic ventures are much more difficult to finance.
Very few people who go to the movies pay any attention to who the cinematographer is. Do you wish that things were different and that more people knew the work of the cinematographers, just as more people now seem to know who the directors are?
No, I think it's all one. You know, I think of myself as a craftsman, you know, and probably we have more recognition now than ever, you know. But no, I think the work in itself is most important. That the photography shouldn't stand outside of what the work is in itself, you know. So, you know, I think this all came about because of auteurism and the idea. But, you know, it's this collective process that makes the film.
Has the technology changed so much since you started that your technique or what you can do is really different?
Well, you know, they made faster and faster film stocks. It means the film can respond to light at much lower levels. They've made lenses that are faster and faster, meaning that they... So I think what's happened, and they made cameras smaller and smaller. So what's happened is it allows us to, like, be in and around things that are happening around us. I mean, I think, like, video is important because, again, you know, it's become more of a democratic process. Anybody can make a film, you know, and create change. And the Rodney King episode, you know, that's, and I think that's important that, you know, that it can be a tool not of just of the rich or the elite, that it can be a tool for anyone to express, you know, their innermost ideas and beliefs.
Since your grandfather and your father ran movie theaters, do you despair now when you go to the movies at the, you know, all the multiplexes? Some of them are really nice and new, but some of them have gotten incredibly small and really run down.
The size of the theater, I just care about the projection, you know, that the demise of, especially in New York City, how poor the projection facilities are. And the answer usually is when I go up to the booth that, well, no one else has complained, you know.
You go up to the booth?
All the time. You know, if they miss focus or, well, sure.
Do you identify yourself? Hi, Ed Lachman, cinematographer here,
no,
and you're
no,
out of focus.
No, I usually say I know the cinematographer, and I know that's not what they would, you know, appreciate.
One last question for you. Has anybody ever told you you look like the young Woody Allen?
Yeah, but then I met Woody Allen. I didn't get the resemblance, but yeah, people have told me that.
Oh, really? How'd you meet him?
I actually shot an end sequence to Alice that wasn't used.
Oh.
That he wanted a kind of someone that could deal with documentary and narrative. It was, you know, when she finds herself and that she's going to go work for Mother Teresa, he wanted sequences of homeless in New York, and he wanted footage shot in New York of the homeless. And I went out with Pam Yates and did footage in New York of that.
Ed Lachman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the award from the festival.
Thank you.
Ed Lachman will be honored tomorrow night at the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Frances Lear. When she was in her 60s, she left her husband Norman Lear and started Lear's Magazine. In her new memoir, she tells about her troubled life, an abusive stepfather, several suicide attempts, and years in the shadow of a famous husband. And it isn't even summer yet, but it's already time for summer sequels. Guest film critic John Powers reviews Lethal Weapon 3. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Astronauts in the space shuttle Endeavour head back to Earth tomorrow. This afternoon, they held a news conference concerning their week in space. The highlight of their mission was the rescue of a stranded communication satellite earlier this week. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
It was a time to reflect on the week's activities in space from the shuttle's principal players. The Endeavour crew, speaking to reporters back on Earth, took time to describe the rescue mission that saw the capture and redeployment of a stranded communication satellite. Astronaut Pierre Thewitt, who had trouble grabbing hold of the satellite with a specially designed capture bar, said that the difficulty with recreating weightlessness on Earth made the maneuver almost impossible. In addition to today's news conference, the crew spent the day storing their spacesuits and cleaning the cabin in preparation for landing tomorrow afternoon at Edwards Air Force Base in California. At least one NASA official says the success of the Endeavour mission finally brings to an end the post-Challenger era for the space agency. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
In Los Angeles, a judge has ruled that L.A. police officer Lawrence Powell will be tried again on the single charge of assault under color of authority. A mistrial was declared last month on the one charge in connection with the videotape beating of motorist Rodney King. Powell and three other L.A. officers were acquitted on all other charges against them. A hearing is set for next week on whether the Powell trial will be moved out of Los Angeles. The largest property company in the world, Olympic & York, has filed for bankruptcy protection. The company is $18.5 billion in debt, and for the last 2 months has tried to restructure $12 billion of this. Daniel Jeffries reports.
Olympia & York was built by the three Reichman brothers, who won a soaring reputation in the 1970s and early 1980s by buying at the bottom of the collapse in property prices at the start of each decade. But the secretive trio's luck ran out in the late 1980s, when they began to borrow heavily to build and buy property at the top of an overinflated property price boom. By the beginning of this year, a significant number of their properties were producing less in rent than the loan payments attached to the building. That's when Olympia & York's banks closed in, demanding payments. The company was forced to seek bankruptcy protection today after a judgment by a London court on Thursday that Olympia & York must make prompt payment of $240 million to New York-based investment bank Morgan Stanley. A company spokesman today denied the company was bust and said after the restructuring of its debts, Olympia & York would still emerge as the world's largest property developer. For National Public Radio, this is Daniel Jeffries in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 15 points to close at 3,353.09 on volume of some 192 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 5-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The State Department has condemned Serbia and the Yugoslav Army for the latest fighting in both Bosnia and eastern Croatia. At the same time, a spokeswoman said the U.S. is giving no consideration to taking part in any armed intervention. Yesterday, U.N. officials said that they had worked out a new ceasefire in Bosnia among the various warring factions. And now the U.N. has called for an end to the fighting there. In Germany, officials have filed murder charges against Erich Honecker and other top former East German leaders. So far, officials in Russia have declined to extradite Honecker, who has been in Chile's embassy in Moscow since last December. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The group of former East German communist officials are charged with issuing shoot-to-kill orders along the Berlin Wall for defectors fleeing the country. In addition to former leader Erich Honecker, the accused include former Stasi chief Erich Milke and former parliamentary president Willy Stoff. More than 200 people lost their lives trying to escape from East Germany. Six border guards have already been convicted on manslaughter charges for shooting deaths at the border. Berlin justice officials are preparing charges on dozens of additional cases. But the justice system has been criticized for the trials without filing suit against the leaders who issued the orders. Honecker refuses to voluntarily return to Germany to face trial. For National Public Radio, this is Dietra Berger in Frankfurt.
President Bush says the U.S. will continue to keep troops in the Persian Gulf region as long as they are needed there. In a letter to Congress, Mr. Bush said that Iraq is still not cooperating fully in a number of areas, including returning all property seized from Kuwait. There are now some 18,000 U.S. troops in the Persian Gulf region, most of them, according to the White House and the Navy. The government says that the nation's industrial production was up by 0.5% in the month of April. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today, at the age of 68, Frances Lear describes her life as happy and fulfilling. She founded Lear's Magazine in 1988 to fill the need for a stylish, popular magazine for older women. The money came from a divorce settlement from TV producer Norman Lear. They'd been married for 30 years. But in the new memoir that Frances Lear wrote, she reveals that happiness and self-esteem are relatively new to her life. She lived in the shadow of her famous husband. When she was young, her adoptive mother shunned her. Her adoptive father killed himself when she was 11. Her stepfather molested her. Frances tried to commit suicide several times. She opens her memoir questioning whether she should have been born at all. She was unwanted. She was born in a home for wayward girls, to a mother barely in her teens, who put Frances up for adoption when she was 14 months old. Lear writes that, as a fetus, she was a strong argument for abortion.
I know that's a powerful line to everyone. I am extremely, totally pro-choice. But when I wrote that page, because I think it's only one page and a half, it was 20 years ago. I was very, very depressed, and I did not want to live.
So this opening actually comes from 20 years ago, right before suicide attempt?
No, I don't remember when I actually wrote the page, but I know that it's very old, about 20 years old, and I gave it to my assistant, and I said, please put this someplace where you can retrieve it, because I know that I will need it someday.
Your mother had three abortions after she adopted you, because you say she had the abortions because she was afraid pregnancy would make her breasts sag.
My mother was an extremely vain woman. She was very pretty and very seductive, very charming, witty, not a good mother, not a loving person. And I learned a great deal from her about what things look like, but I didn't learn much about what things feel like.
Your adoptive mother said to you that she chose you in the orphanage because you were the prettiest child there. You were adopted at 14 months, and you write that your mother kept you shut up in your room until your orphanage haircut grew out. It sounds like your mother was very obsessed with looks.
Yes, she was. She was extraordinarily vain. I know that I osmosed much of her feeling about looks, and I've tried all through the years to get rid of it as much as I could. I still think it's very important to be attractive and to keep oneself looking as good as you can, but I don't love people because they're pretty, as my mother did.
What are the different stages you went through in your life in terms of being obsessed with your own looks?
I think that as a young woman, I depended upon my looks for almost everything. I never thought that I had a brain. Nobody ever told me I had one. Certainly my mother wouldn't have recognized it if I had one. I did poorly in school because I was a very troubled child. And all I had, it seemed to me, was a good body and a fairly good face. And that was my wealth. And as I grew older and my looks began to change, I went through torture because I didn't have a self. I had these fading features, which were going to keep fading. We're not going to get any better. And I think at that time I realized that women who are attractive and rely upon their looks have a terrible, terrible time with aging. I've kept fighting that, and now I believe that that whatever I have that is attractive is infinitely more important than what I had as a young woman.
But you've had a facelift, haven't you?
Oh, several times.
So you feel comfortable about that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that more and more people are having facelifts because of the job market, not just because of vanity. And sexual viability is another reason. I mean, I want to be sexually viable until I stop walking.
Some people would see it as a contradiction that you, the editor of Lear's, which is supposed to kind of celebrate the older woman, is trying to kind of almost like deny her age by getting her facelifted.
No, I have to explain Lear's position on this.
Mm-hmm.
The pure feminist party line would say, don't do anything, just grow old gracefully. Lear's would say, you also may, if you wish, keep yourself as attractive as you can, as youthful looking as you can, because that pleases you. But if you want to be Germaine Greer and grow old gracefully, go.
Let's continue in talking about some of the things that happened to you early on and how they affected your choices later in life. Your father killed himself when you were 11 years old. Do you know why he took his life?
No, of course not, but I have manufactured many stories through the years. It was during the Depression. A lot of men took their lives. He lost his business. He lost his house. He went out and bought an insurance policy for a great deal of money. And 3 weeks later, he committed suicide. Unfortunately, when parents commit suicide, children and even grandchildren believe that suicide is a solution to one's problems, which, of course, it is not. And I grew up with that solution in the front of my mind every time I was in a deep clinical depression. And so I have attempted suicide and almost made it. But inside of me is something that wants to live.
Good. Your mother remarried after your father committed suicide. Your stepfather sexually abused you. Fondling, not penetration. What really surprised me, what surprised me is not only the revelation, you know, that you'd been abused, but the very surprising part of that was that you were saying you kind of enjoyed the human contact. You know, you'd been so kind of, I guess, deprived of love in the family. And what was even more surprising is you talk about being somewhat aroused by it.
This is most difficult part of incest, because most children who are incested are in homes where they are not getting the love that they need from both parents. And to have someone come to you and want you and love you and touch you, and it is, you feel belong, that you are loved, that you are a person. Then, of course, you know somewhere in the back of your head, you know that it is wrong, that this is something you should not do. But our needs as children are very complicated, and incest is a very complicated issue.
You use the kind of collective we to say that children who had been the victims of incest found something almost loving about the contact. I don't think that's universally true at all. I'm sure that's true of some people. But
no, I agree with you. It is not universally true, but it is often true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is probably truer than we have heard, because it's very difficult for people to say that.
You told your psychiatrist when you were 13 about the incest.
I actually was 16.
I'm sorry. Okay, thank you for correcting me. And what your psychiatrist did was call up your parents, invite them to the next session, and tell them some of what you had told the doctor. You went home, and then your stepfather came at you with a kitchen knife. Do you think your psychiatrist did the right thing in telling your parents?
I think she betrayed me. I think that was the first betrayal. in my life. I never considered my father's suicide a betrayal. And I had a very hard time with the psychiatric community after that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frances Lear, the founder of Lear's Magazine and author of a new memoir called The Second Seduction. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Frances Lear. I want to talk with you a little bit about self-esteem and the effects of marriage on that for you. You had a career basically in the finer department stores as a buyer for women's departments. And after a rocky start, you seemed to be doing pretty well in that career. You gave that up when you started your third marriage, your marriage to Norman Lear. From your book, I get the feeling you were sorry you gave it up.
Yes, I was, because I should have done both. But in those days, it was very hard to do both. It was certainly hard to do it in retailing. The hours are very long. You take buying trips many times a year. I would have had to be away from my family. And I would not risk my marriage at that point.
During the first years that you were a mother, you didn't work. You stayed home with the children. You even took up embroidery. And then you read Betty Friedan's book. And at first you were very angry, and you even wrote an angry article about it, because why? You felt that it was saying your life wasn't worth anything?
Yes, I thought she was wrong, that I was perfectly happy, that this was the way to live. And, of course, very soon I realized that she was not wrong. That me as a human being and my life were only partial, and that there was something much more out there that I needed to have. I had had it before I was married. I had worked and achieved a certain amount of success, and I was known as that. Now I became known as somebody's wife, And Betty Friedan spoke to me. She was writing about me.
How did you change your life when you became involved with the women's movement?
Well, I got out into something that has been lost, unfortunately, but that was the glory of the movement, and that's sisterhood. I began to meet other women who were in similar or unhappy situations. And we talked to each other, and we worked in groups, and we marched, and we raised money, and we changed the country, and probably the world.
I think for a lot of people, when they turn 60, that's seen as the beginning of the end. For you, life really changed for the better in so many ways in your 60s. Everything from giving up drinking to starting Lear's Magazine to feeling that you really found yourself again as a person. Why did that happen to you in your 60s, do you think?
Well, I don't know, except that it simply, I'm a late bloomer, I suppose, and that's and it took me a long time to do what other people do much earlier, also because of the times I was living in. I mean, I must believe, and I think I am correct in believing this, that I would not be here if it were not for the women's movement. That changed my life. It changed everybody's life. And if I had been 40 in the women's movement, or if I had been 20 and the women's movement had come along, then my life would have changed then. So history and I interface very, very closely.
Yeah, but the women's movement, I mean, the renaissance of that goes back about 20 years.
Yes.
And Lear's is about 4 years old, so there was a little bit of a gap there between the women's movement and you turning 60.
Well, I have to explain that gap. It took me a long time to change. One does not get out of a very traditional mindset in 20 minutes. I mean, I'm 68 years old. My mother and my grandmother and I lived in this role, and it was as much a part of me as independence and freedom is my own children's role. This enormous fight that I fought for about 15 years to come free is nothing that can be done overnight. Mm-hmm. Everything, every part of you has to change. And there is a lot of resistance.
When you and Norman Lear divorced, you came into millions and millions of dollars through the settlement. Did that enable you to start Lear's magazine? And I guess I'm wondering, when you have a lot of money, you have a lot of options. Was it a difficult period figuring out, well, which option should you choose?
No, it was very simple. I knew about the magazine before I left California. I worked very hard for that money. Some people think that that divorce settlements are just handed over because you live or because you're divorced. No, they are earned. I earned that money. And I used it for a magazine that I had conceived 6 months before I left to come to New York.
The cover of the current issue of Lear's has Ivana Trump on the cover, and there's a kind of photographic spread of her inside. Is that the image that you wanted for Lear's?
The cover pictures are a long story. I have a general manager who is the biggest newsstand consultant in America, and I have promised him 3 years of motion picture stars on the cover for newsstand sales. From then on, I can have women. But I must pay attention to circulation for a while.
So that was a circulation decision?
Yes, yes. Covers are a circulation decision, even though we like some of the covers very much.
Can I ask if you're in a relationship now?
Yes, I am. I am always in a relationship. I cannot live without love and work. I must have both. I am Freud's girl.
Okay.
I think he was wrong about hysteria in women, but he was right about love and work.
Well, Frances Lear, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Frances Lear's new memoir is called The Second Seduction. This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. A Los Angeles judge has ordered a retrial of one of the police officers accused of beating Rodney King. A hearing on the venue is set for next week. NPR's Ina Jaffe has a report. Also from L.A., there's a tentative truce between two of the toughest gangs, the Crips and the Bloods. Wendy Kaufman talks to experts and law enforcement officials who are skeptical, saying the truce won't last unless these young men have new opportunities for jobs and education. And Don Gagne reports that Dr. Kevorkian, known as the suicide doctor, has engineered another suicide in a Detroit suburb. The woman was suffering from malignant multiple sclerosis. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. At Christmas time, Hollywood releases the movies it hopes will be prestigious, but this time of year, they seg into those surefire moneymakers. Batman 3 will be out in June. Next week, Alien 3 premieres. To kick it all off, this week, the big movie is Lethal Weapon 3. Guest film critic John Powers has this review.
Karl Marx, remember him? He once said that history repeats itself. The first time is tragedy, the second is farce. I can't imagine what he'd say about Hollywood, where hit movies don't merely repeat themselves, but spawn an endless spree of chuckle-headed sequels. Take Lethal Weapon 3. It's less a full-fledged movie than a two-hour trailer for itself. Mel Gibson brings back his role as Martin Riggs, the wild, long-maned cop who's teamed with Roger Murtaugh, once again played by Danny Glover. Murtaugh's a cautious middle-aged family man who wants nothing more than safe passage through the final days before his retirement. Fat chance. Within minutes, the two are chasing a crooked cop who's been selling primo weaponry to L.A. street gangs. Not that Riggs and Murtaugh spend a lot of time doing police work, mind you. Most of the movie's devoted to their crowd-pleasing shtick, as when they try to bust a guy for jaywalking.
Can we speed this up, please? You may have nothing to do. I have things to do today, okay?
No, we can't. So will you shut up?
Jaywalking.
Yeah?
license? Jaywalking?
I don't have it on me, okay? I wasn't driving, okay? I was walking. What do I need, a walking license now?
Let's just shoot
him. Is he crazy?
Get out of the way, Rod. I'm going to drill him. Will you make it look like suicide? Get out of the way. Will you make it look like suicide?
The video camera.
I don't care. I'm still going to drill him. Get out of the way.
Get out of here before my brother kills you.
No, that way. Not that way. This way.
This way.
Over there. Go right now.
Their final laughter says it all, as does that joke about video cameras, which has a mighty creepy ring coming 2 weeks after the Rodney King verdict. Now, I don't want to sound nostalgic for the original movie, but at least Lethal Weapon took its idea seriously. Back then, Gibson's Riggs was agonized, self-destructive psycho, the sort of extreme personality who seldom gets put on screen as a hero. And Glover's Murtaugh was a rare movie type, too, a responsible black man with a middle-class family. The whole emotional point of that picture was to show how these two very different men came to need and care for one another. Everything that could be done with the duo was done in the first film. But would McDonald's close down because it had perfected the Big Mac? Of course not. And so the Lethal Weapon franchise has gone the way of James Bond, Nightmare on Elm Street, and many other series. It's descended into jokiness. Riggs is no longer a man on the edge. Even when he's blowing people away, he seems as harmlessly cute as a puppy. And as Murtaugh, poor Danny Glover, normally a dignified actor, has been forced to do the kind of eye-popping and gibbering you found in step-and-fetch-it roles half a century ago. For a movie that uses gang violence as a hook, Lethal Weapon 3 is appallingly cavalier in its treatment of a key reason for that violence, the abuse of police power. In fact, director Richard Donner asks us to hoot each time his heroes beat up an innocent citizen, mock the Bill of Rights, or blow a public building sky high. During the riots in L.A., rattled news anchors kept calling the violence senseless and asking, what do those people really want anyway? I found myself asking the same question about the Hollywood bigwigs who made this movie, which presents an orgy of death and destruction as cheerful family fun. What was scariest about the riots was the sense that nothing mattered, tradition, community, people's homes, human lives. And what's scariest about Lethal Weapon 3 is that it celebrates an identical fantasy of gleeful, meaningless violence. A fantasy sure to draw a huge audience, even in those neighborhoods where folks are confident they would never go burning or looting. The truth is, these days there's a riot going on inside us all.
John Powers reviews films for LA Weekly and New York Magazine. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we call up Salman Rushdie to talk about his new book of essays. Also, just in time for the season finale of Northern Exposure, we talk with John Cullum, who plays Holling Vincor, the tavern owner. We spoke at a tavern in the Pacific Northwest. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.